right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Iran's president is responding to a threat by the United States that it might pull out of the Iran nuclear deal. Reuters' David Doyle explains.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani had a warning for the United States on Sunday. If Donald Trump scraps the 2015 nuclear accord, then America will regret it. Rouhani also said the country has plans to resist any move by Trump, but failure of the deal, which Rouhani promoted, could leave him looking vulnerable. Analysts and officials have told Reuters that if America withdraws, then Iranian hardliners are waiting in the wings to bring the relatively moderate Rouhani to heel and constrain his ability to open Iran up to the West.
That's Reuters' David Doyle reporting. A powerful bomb ripped through a crowded mosque in southeastern Afghanistan, killing at least 12 worshippers and wounding 33 others. The attack came hours after unknown gunmen in a northern Afghan region kidnapped 7 engineers, mostly Indian nationals. The mosque bombing occurred in Khost province, which borders Pakistan. Provincial Afghan police chief confirmed the death toll to VOA. He said that the worship place was also serving as a voter registration center, and he anticipates the death toll will rise. No one immediately claimed responsibility for the attack. Hassan Iqbal, Pakistan's federal interior minister, survived an assassination attempt Sunday in the central Punjab province. Police confirmed the attack, saying the minister sustained a bullet injury in his right shoulder. Iqbal was quickly taken to a nearby hospital for treatment, where doctors described his condition as stable. He was shot at twice while he was getting in his vehicle. The shooter is in his early 20s and said to be a local resident, and he's been arrested. This is VOA News. Thousands across Russia have demonstrated that they are not in support of a fourth term for Russian President Vladimir Putin. AP's Ben Thomas reports.
Thousands of demonstrators crowded into Moscow's Pushkin Square in a day of protests across Russia ahead of Vladimir Putin's inauguration for a fourth term as president. A monitoring group says more than 350 people have been arrested around the country. Ben Thomas, AP Radio News.
Residents of Hawaii's Big Island remain on high alert after the Kilauea volcano gushed more lava on the island's eastern side, forcing more evacuations. Lava, molten rock, and toxic gas continue to plague area neighborhoods following a 6.9 magnitude earthquake, the island's largest tremor in more than 40 years. New Civil Defense Administrator Talmadge Magno.
4 or 5 landslides on the Hamakua coastline. Public works and state highways, we're dealing opening those. And, I think one of them at least shut down 2 lanes. But didn't sound like it was going to be anything more extensive than that. I know some buildings had some minor damage. I heard it throughout Hilo Town, but pretty much that was it.
There have been no reports of deaths or injuries. Officials warn that they have detected high levels of sulfur gas. For the first time in 9 years, Lebanese voters this Sunday participate in parliamentary elections. Security concerns have postponed the vote several times. The main competition is between the Western-backed coalition of Prime Minister Saad Hariri's Future Movement Party and the Iranian-backed Hezbollah group. 86 women are running for seats in Lebanon's 128-member parliament. For a second time in 2 days, there's been violence in Indian Kashmir. 5 rebels and 5 civilians were killed in the Himalayan region, while dozens more were injured during anti-Indian protests. Australia continues to have its attempts to join the rapidly growing space industry. It's set to receive a multi-multi-million-dollar boost. It does have many startups, some of which have struck deals with NASA and other international agencies. Phil Mercer reports for VOA.
A company in Australia's Northern Territory is working with indigenous groups to build a launch site. Professor Anna Moore, a member of the Australian Government's Expert Reference Group, which advises officials on creating a space agency, says a cash boost in this week's federal budget will go a long way.
The $50 million injection is a great start for setting up the agency itself. We're talking about setting up the administration, the legal aspects, working across government.
The Australian space industry has grown by about 10% annually.
That's Phil Mercer reporting for VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
They promised Malawians that they would stage and mount a sustained campaign against the fight against corruption. But what do we see? More than ever before, the country is more corrupt.
Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika keeps promises to Malawians in a State of the Nation address.
The best way we can honor his name is to follow his path, to follow the peaceful process that he initiated with the President Nyusi.
The family of former Mozambican rebel leader Afonso Dhlakama meet this weekend to plan his funeral arrangements.
The UN Refugee Agency estimates approximately 26 million people in the Lake Chad region have been affected by the Boko Haram violence and more than 2.6 million displaced.
And Boko Haram fighters attack villages in the far north region of Cameroon, leaving at least a dozen dead. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika says he has kept his promises to Malawians in a State of the Nation address, but his address was often interrupted by members of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP. Earlier, the supporters blocked lawmakers from getting into parliament and harassed journalists. The behavior has been widely condemned by opposition and civil society groups as an affront to democracy and the rule of law. They accuse the ruling party of using their supporters to distract from the government's failure to improve the lives of Malawians. For more, I reach Vincent Kondwe, a governance consultant and a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi.
I think the last 4 years that Mutharika has been in power have been the last 4 years where Malawians have not significantly and substantively benefited from the policy promises that the Peter Mutharika had promised Malawians in 2014. This is quite visible. When you look at the energy sector, as a country, Malawi, we have got blackouts each and every day which are affecting the industry. You look at the health sector, it is in tatters. You look at the education sector, there's poor infrastructure. So in terms of delivering, this current government from 2014 up to now has not delivered what they promised Malawians. They promised Malawians that they would stage and mount a sustained campaign against the fight against corruption. But what do we see? More than ever before, the country is more corrupt.
Some of his supporters are saying that those who have been proving to have embezzled public funds are being dealt with. Some who were alleged to have participated in the infamous Cashgate have been prosecuted successfully. These, among others, they said, are indications of the president's commitment to weed out corruption in the country, and he needs to be praised for it. What is your response to that?
That is missing the actual point, because all those who have been prosecuted are linked to an opposition political party. They are sympathizers of the previous ruling party of Dr. Joyce Banda. We are talking of currently a vice president of a ruling party being accused of embezzling billions of Malawi kwacha, and then is being retained as a vice president of a ruling party. Yes, I'm talking of Dr. George Chaponda. They removed him as a minister of agriculture, but they retained him as a vice president of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party. That in itself speaks volumes that the fight against corruption is mere rhetoric.
Some of his supporters of the ruling DPP are confident that Malawians will repose confidence in President Arthur Peter Mutharika by voting for him massively in next year's election. As a political analyst, what are your thoughts about his prospect of winning re-election next year?
Malawi as a country is in desperate need of leadership that is inspirational, of leadership that looks at development with a national lens. Malawi is in need of leadership that can take the country out of the economic doldrums that is found itself in. I don't see that leadership being represented by the current leadership. So the country is in desperate need of an economic messiah. The country is in desperate need of that kind of leadership that would lead to Malawi as a developmental state, whereby the leadership must inspire and rally the entire nation towards achieving goals whose economic benefits trickle down to the local man at the village level. Currently, that leadership is not represented by the current ruling clique. As such, the country, the mood in the country is one that is desirous of political change. That is my current analysis of the situation.
There seems to be a division in the ruling DPP, where some people are saying they want the vice president to be chosen to run as the presidential candidate of the party, saying that Peter Arthur Mutharika is too old. Some are saying that he has done so well that he should be left for him to complete the job that he has begun. What is your take?
Being old, to me, is not a problem. But the current old man has lost grip of the country. The current old man does not know what is happening in the country. The current old man is not steering the ship in the right direction. Therefore, the vice president represents a kind of political renewal, a kind of political regeneration that is reconnecting very well with the majority of Malawians who are the youth. Therefore, the voices from within the party are those voices that have been connected to the ordinary Malawian who is suffering in the villages. The DPP, as a political party, must be able to listen to the voices of reason that are coming from within. If that does not happen, it is very, very difficult for the ruling DPP to win the 2019 political elections, everything being equal, because we know of the incumbency factor in the African political scenario.
Vincent Kondwe is a governance consultant and a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. The family of former Mozambican rebel leader Afonso Dhlakama will meet this weekend to plan his funeral arrangement. Until his death Thursday, Afonso Dhlakama led the opposition RENAMO in peace negotiations with the government of President Filipe Nyusi. Dhlakama led the RENAMO rebel movement in a 16-year civil war against the government, which ended in 1992. Meanwhile, President Nyusi has called for calm following the opposition leader's death. To learn more about what Afonso Dhlakama meant to the opposition party and the people of Mozambique, I reach Eduardo Namburetti, the head of the opposition RENAMO's external relations in the Mozambican capital, Maputo.
Well, it's a mixture of feelings. He represents the freedom he represents, has himself, he used to say that he was the father of democracy, because in fact he is the one who led the struggle for democracy in this country. The freedom of expression, of press, all sorts of freedoms that we are exercising today is in big part thanks to the struggle that he took when he was young. At the age of 23, 24, he took up that mission to lead the people of Mozambique in the struggle for democracy, for the freedom. So for the Mozambicans, he represents that figure of the one who really brought democracy into action in this country. And for the party, he represents the pillar, a strong pillar that put together this party all the way from its inception. So it's a big loss for all of us at RENAMO and for all the Mozambicans. And you can feel that in every way you go, everybody, you know, expressing their sadness for this big loss.
So what led to his death? Was he sick?
Well, it was not a long illness. I have no details of what may have caused this death, but nothing indicated that this would happen. I personally spoke with him on Monday, and in our greetings, he expressed to be feeling okay and nothing indicated that this would happen. It was a surprise to many of us because we did not learn of any serious illness that could create such a situation.
President Nyusi called for calm due to the fact that Afonso Dhlakama was working with the government to ensure the country remains peaceful. Will RENAMO support his measure to ensure the country remains peaceful despite his demise?
Yes, that was one of his wish, of seeing this process move smoothly to the end. And the best way we can honor his name is to follow his path, to follow the peaceful process that he initiated with the President Nyusi, in order that the country will know a smooth peace negotiation throughout up to the end. Of course, people are saddened, have mixed of feelings and so on, but it is up to us and the leadership of the party or the members to remain calm and go through this mourning process together with the family and resume the talks from where President Dhlakama left the negotiation and hopefully conclude the whole process as soon as possible.
Talking about the leadership, when do you anticipate the party's leadership coming together to choose another leader to fill the void?
Well, at this moment, we are concentrating our thoughts in mourning and being close to the family and supporting the family, supporting the members and the sympathizers of the party. After all that, then the party throughout its structures will then meet and decide the best way to continue its work, to continue the work of the party. It's not an issue that is on the table at this moment. For this time, we are concentrating in our mourning and comforting the family and the members and getting close to those who are now in deep sorrow.
Eduardo Dambureti is the head of the opposition RENAMO's external relations in Mozambique. He spoke with me from Maputo. Boko Haram fighters have attacked villages in the far north region of Cameroon, leaving at least a dozen dead. Several soldiers were also wounded and the villages torched in a large operation involving hundreds of attackers, some of whom used villages as human shields. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka traveled to the site with the military and has others report.
Children gathered in little groups along the road shout to welcome the Cameroon military in Mabanda, a northern village on the border with Nigeria. It is one of the villages that suffered the latest Boko Haram assaults this week. 43-year-old village elder Alihu Idrisu says groups of fighters infiltrated the faithful praying in mosques and sellers and buyers on their market day Wednesday.
L'heure de la prière. Ils sont au niveau de la mosquée. Dans la mosquée, ils étaient au nombre de 8. Donc l'imam avait ces gens. Voilà.
He says one group of 8 armed men invaded the mosque while they were praying and ordered the imam and all Muslims present to lead them to a nearby Cameroon military post. He says those who objected were killed. Idrisu says the militants operated for over 2 hours and killed at least 14 villagers, whom they accused of failing to inform Boko Haram when Cameroon army arrived in their village ahead of raids on the insurgents' strongholds in the Sambisa forest last month. Jean-Pierre Ndanga, a Cameroon military officer in Mabanda, says they found it extremely difficult to fight back because the invaders were using villagers as human shields.
Nous sommes arrivés à la localité de Mabanda où
He says when he ordered his troops to get down from their military jeep and move towards hundreds of villagers they saw marching towards the Mabanda village square, they suddenly heard gunshots and immediately understood that Boko Haram fighters were using the people as shields. He says he and many of the troops were wounded as they struggled to retreat to protect the villagers. Jean-Pierre was rushed to the Mabanda Health Center alongside dozens of injured military and villagers. Laboratory technician Dieudonné Besson says they attended to all of the wounded without discrimination.
Il y en a qui ont eu la vie sauve grâce à la prompte réaction.
He says many villagers had their lives saved thanks to the immediate intervention of health workers. He says four seriously wounded villagers were given the same surgical treatment as wounded military men. Cameroon's military says the militants fled to neighboring Nigeria after the attack, but at least seven of the insurgents were killed. Cameroon's semi-arid far north region has been a target of Boko Haram suicide bombings and raids for close to 9 years as the Islamist insurgency spilled over the border from Nigeria, killing at least 25,000 in the Lake Chad Basin shared by Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad and Niger. The UN Refugee Agency estimates approximately 26 million people in the Lake Chad region have been affected by the Boko Haram violence and more than 2.6 million displaced. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Mabanda, Northern Cameroon.
Last Friday capped the third and final week of the International Visitor Leadership Program, or IVLP. It's a key component of the U.S. State Department's annual Global Security Conference. It brought together over 80 international law enforcement and other officials to discuss security threats, including terrorism and cybercrime. At least 15 African nations organizations were represented. To find out more about the IVLP, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Ndubuisi Christian, a Nigerian-born peace and security expert with the Institute of Security Studies based in Ethiopia.
The IVLP program is very remarkable. It brings a wide variety of people from different countries to learn best practices on how to address transnational crimes, money laundering, terrorism financing, cyber threats, and all that. Peacekeepers need to know how to address some of these challenges.
I know that peacekeepers often keep the peace by fighting those who would disturb the peace, like terrorists or interethnic clashes or conflicts. I didn't realize the digital world was one of their battlefields.
In Africa, we have peacekeepers who actually engage in combat against violent extremist groups. But terrorist elements are being supported through money laundering, terrorism financing, and also cyber crimes.
Okay, so you're saying that in order to keep the peace, you have to make sure that these bad actors aren't funded, and that's where the financial anti-cyber espionage and security comes in, to the peacekeeping role.
Exactly.
You did mention before that there are three different types of peacekeeping: military, police and law enforcement, and civilian peacekeeping at the grassroots.
They're all components of a particular peacekeeping mission. So the military component is in charge of security, providing deterrence from warring factions fighting. And then the police component is ensuring that there's a rule of law within recovered areas, either from terrorist elements like Boko Haram or from warring factions or places that have been devastated and there's no law and order, while the civilian provides a more strategic guidance to the mission, analysis on how to address those issues.
What are some of the specific challenges the African Union faces with regard to some of these issues?
There's a lot of migration flows and terrorism into other countries within the continent of Africa, but the few that make their way into Europe contribute to brain drain. That is a challenge that needs to be addressed for the security of Africa.
Are people migrating within Africa and from Africa to Europe because they're fleeing terrorism and other sorts of crime, Or are you saying that migration is an actual cause of crime?
The Institute for Security Studies have carried out extensive research on this, and we've not found any link between migrants and transnational crime. The only link that we find is that people are looking for greener pastures to other places where they can find peace and where they can find economic progress. Those are the two major aspects.
Tell me, what is one thing that you learned, something that when you landed in the United States you didn't know and now you do know?
Cybercrimes is a global challenge. States have to enhance their cyber networks, as in cyber capacities, where there's in-depth analysis about cyber threats and how to address those. Secondly, there has to be a global alliance for the cyberspace and how to manage that. At the moment, there's no regulation on what happens in the cyberspace. And everyone can do whatever they want to do. So there's need for that regulation to come in place.
Okay. And when you get back and people welcome you back from this wonderful conference and ask you, okay, what should we do now? What are you going to tell them?
Two things I will ask them to do is, one, create a joint task force, the police, civilian component, and also the military component, working together hand in hand. And then secondly, at the grassroots level, we have to be aware that security threat is not limited to issues of violence, physical violence, but it's also a broader focus on things like the financing of terrorism, money laundering, and all that, which all contribute to insecurities.
With elections a few months away, Zimbabwe's ruling party, ZANU-PF, launched its campaign and manifesto on Friday. For VOA, Kutsai's Vanavashi has the report from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
The sound in the background is from ZANU-PF supporters responding to slogans chanted by President Emmerson Mnangagwa at the ZANU-PF manifesto and campaign launch. Mnangagwa urged fellow party members who plan to run for office to campaign for the party.
I now appeal to my fellow candidates to now go out and humbly canvass for the vote of the people of Zimbabwe. Ours is a call to be servants of the people.
The party's campaign theme is running under the taglines: unite, fight corruption, develop, re-engage, and create jobs. These speak to what Mnangagwa has been preaching since his inauguration. And he has been preaching democracy within his party.
We remain convinced that the democratic course we have started in the management of our party affairs is the correct one. We must thus never deviate from the bold decision we took to deepen and strengthen our internal democratic systems.
Mnangagwa says ZANU-PF is breaking from its past for a new path.
Leaders must always come from the people. The days of imposition, chicanery, and favoritism in our internal electoral processes are dead and buried. Never again resurrected, no matter the person's status or standing.
The manifesto seeks to build support in the coming election with its economic policies that seek to improve the standard of living through re-engaging with the rest of the world, attracting foreign direct investment, and creating jobs. Critics have expressed concern that Mnangagwa is promising a better economy, affordable healthcare, and affordable education for all, something the ZANU-PF could have done in the past 38 years they have been in power. At the last election, the ruling party promised jobs to millions of people, but the high unemployment rate is evident. Time will tell if Zimbabweans believe these election promises and are willing to back them with their ballots. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, refugees in one of Uganda's settlements are decrying inadequate water supplies. They are coping with the problem by traveling long distances or waiting for hours in queues. There have also been reports of clashes between refugees and host communities over water resources. For VOA, Catherine Nambi files this report from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Atuke Dede is a South Sudan refugee woman living in Bidibidi refugee settlement in Yumbe district. She spends nearly a whole day in a queue waiting for her turn to fill at least 5 cans with water. It's a frustrating experience.
But the water, when the rain is raining, the water is okay. But when the dry season, water is not enough. Then we come very early in the morning, and then maybe you will fetch water in the evening. But because at home you want to be with the full water, but then if you come, you don't find water, the whole day you'll not feel okay.
Dede is only one of several hundred thousand people in Bidibidi who are struggling to cope with water shortages. Robert Bariamwesiga is Bidibidi settlement commandant. He describes the challenge facing a typical household.
One of them is walking long distance to reach water. That's number one challenge. Two, we've not yet reached the required water per capita standard. We are supposed to reach at least 20 liters per person per day. We are still fluctuating between 13 and 16 liters per person per day. That's a challenge as well.
Bariamwesiga confirms that the lack of water has sometimes led to tensions between local people and Bidibidi residents.
Refugees and the host community share resources together, so there is that struggle for limited water resources. They struggle because we don't have enough yet for all of them. The more we put enough water systems, the lesser the struggle.
Currently, refugees rely on water from aid agencies or from boreholes in the settlements. Bariamwesiga notes that the government and refugee agencies are looking for permanent solutions to replace the use of water trucks.
We've developed so far 27 motorized water systems and more than 100 hand pumps. It's not yet enough because we are still doing some water trucking in some areas. We are working hard. Currently, we are drilling more high-yielding boreholes to motorize them, and we get more water to support the refugees.
Access to water may be a problem for some time to come. Bidibidi was built for 40,000 people, but it holds 287,000 people. Nearly 300,000 more are expected to head for refugee settlements in Uganda this year. Observers say that puts a strain on the country's resources. The best solution, they say, may be a political settlement to the civil conflict in South Sudan. But the turmoil there has been going on for years, and so far there's been no credible end in sight. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go to Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Al Ahly of Egypt and Esperance of Tunisia drew 0-0 on Friday as this season's African Champions League group phase began, allowing Menoas Township Rollers of Botswana to take an early lead in Group A. Ahly and Esperance struggled to score in Alexandria, while Elamponye Chileso goal gave surprise qualifiers Rollers a 1-0 win over Kampala Capital City Authority of Uganda in Haborone. Rollers now top Group A standings with KCCA bottom. Also on Friday, Malodia Alga of Algeria came from behind
with 10 men to draw 1-1 at home against Difa Al Jadid of Morocco and share the Group B lead. Record 8-time champions Ahly missed 2 injured strikers, Moroccan Walid Azaro and Nigerian junior Ajayi, as they failed to score against twice title holders Esperance. It was the 8th draw in 17 matches between the teams across various African competitions, with Ahly winning 6 and Esperance 3. They clashed in the 2017 Champions League quarterfinals, with Ahly winning the second leg near Tunis after being held in Alexandria. In Habarone, Shire Losto timed his run perfectly onto a Joel Magorosi pass and rounded goalkeeper Tom Ikapa score a Rollers winner against KCCA on 36 minutes. Rollers shocked Almeric of Sudan and Young Africans of Tanzania to become the first Botswanan club to reach the last 16. Malodia had Zidane Mabereku sent off early in the second half against Difa El Jadida and fell behind after 77 minutes when Hamida Ahmed of Jadida scored his 7th Champions League goal this season. Amir Karou equalized with 8 minutes remaining in Algiers for Maladia, who had scored 15 goals at home in 2 qualifiers. Jadida now playing in the group phase for the first time and hoped to emulate Moroccan clubs Raja Casablanca, Wydad Casablanca and FAR Rabat by winning the elite African club competition. On Saturday, hosts TP Mazembe of the DR Congo beat Entente Setif of Algeria 4-1 in Group B. Meanwhile, Barcelona are traveled South Africa later this month for a friendly with newly crowned South African champions Mamelodi Sundowns. The match will be played at Soccer City on the outskirts of Johannesburg on May 16th, and it's the second time that Sundowns have brought the Spanish giants out for a friendly match. The game will come just 24 hours after Sundowns play away in Conakry against Horoya in the second of their Group C matches in the African Champions League. Meanwhile, on a sad note, a South African footballer who was struck by lightning during a match has died in hospital, according to his club. Maritzburg United striker Luyanda Mchangase had been in an induced coma since being injured in the friendly game on March 1st. In a statement on Facebook, the club described him as one of its rising youngsters and said the team was in mourning. Maritzburg United are currently fourth in South Africa's Premier League. Nsangase had risen through the club's ranks and made his debut against Kaizer Chiefs 2 seasons ago. He was one of 3 players caught by the bolt of lightning during the match in KwaZulu-Natal. The 2 others were only slightly hurt, but Nsangase suffered burns on his chest, according to South African media report. The player's death is the 3rd tragedy to hit Maritzburg United in recent years. Promising midfielders Mondele Sele and Moldin Dlamini both died in separate car accidents in 2016 and 2017, respectively. And that's it for this edition of Netline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports.
As you can see,
and it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Drinks on me, oh me, oh, oh, for sure. Yes, so that's what's up. Got them blessed, let no man curse. I'm on a true, oh, show love, show love. Everybody needs somebody, oh. If you can call, just sing along to. I'm on a true, oh. As a young girl, we really like fight. Just wanna.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. African critics have questioned whether the time was opportune for Nigerian President Buhari to visit the White House recently. The criticism is made in the background of earlier reports that President Trump had made some negative comments about African states and the Caribbean states. Secondly, there is a widespread feeling that at the present time, the United States hasn't developed a coherent foreign policy, nor a coherent African policy, 1 year since the Trump administration came into being. In addition, there has been no designation of Assistant Secretary of State for Africa. And despite the fact that former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson visited the African Union and some African states just before he was removed, these critics also take into account that the State Department does not seem to be well organized, even though the new Secretary of State Pompeo, in his swearing-in, mentioned a new approach and a new tone for the State Department. But President Buhari may be working under the principle that nations have no permanent friends but permanent interests. And in this regard, Nigeria has many interests which it needs to pursue with the United States, not only because of its own interests, but Nigeria, with the largest African population and the strongest African economy. Buhari wants to strengthen its ties with the Trump administration in the fight against terrorism, particularly Boko Haram. And in this connection, Nigeria has welcomed the fact that President Trump has allowed the sale of some military aircraft to Nigeria, which was not allowed under the Obama administration because of humanitarian concern. There is also an interest in Nigeria to pursue trade and economic relations with the United States. Many business people accompanied President Buhari in his recent visit, and the hope is that the U.S. will strengthen its tie with Nigeria, even though at the present time, China has made spectacular inroads in Nigeria, and it has just been announced that Nigeria and China have agreed on a swap which would allow the yuan to be used in Nigeria in trade. So local currencies will be used, which is very important to many business people in Nigeria. For the purpose of President Trump, he too has an interest in security matters. Recently, there were publications that U.S. troops are deployed in the Sahel, particularly in Niger. And there is every interest, there is every notice that the U.S. wants to strengthen this fight against terrorism in Africa. There is also the interest of President Trump to push trade with Nigeria and many African countries and to compete favorably with China in order to improve the United States balance of trade. So there are these interests which may explain why President Buhari and Nigeria feel that despite some worries, they must be engaged with the United States. Of course, the future will tell whether the new Secretary of State, Pompeo, will be able to promote African interest as was done under the Obama administration. So it is in this context that one should welcome this visit and hope that renewed interest of the United States will overcome some of the criticism and doubts that many Africans may harbor about the Trump administration. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impulga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, John Cummings, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, he that beats the drum for the madman to dance is no better than the madman himself. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States, the global coalition, and local partners, including the Syrian Democratic Forces, are launching operations to liberate the final ISIS strongholds in Syria. The fighting will be difficult, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert, but we and our partners will prevail. We will defend United States, coalition, and partner forces if attacked. The days of ISIS controlling territory and terrorizing the people of Syria are coming to an end, she declared. The United States will work with its NATO ally Turkey and partners Israel, Jordan, Iraq, and Lebanon to secure their borders from ISIS. The U.S. will seek to share in a fair manner contributions in forces, material, and resources from regional partners and allies to stabilize liberated territories. As President Donald Trump said in remarks with President Emmanuel Macron of France, we will ensure that there is a strong and lasting footprint in Syria, such that ISIS cannot return and populations liberated from ISIS are not exploited by the regime of Bashar al-Assad or its Iranian supporters. The U.S. will seek to reinvigorate the Geneva process under United Nations Security Council Resolution 2254 and mobilize international resources to address Syria's urgent humanitarian and stabilization needs. Syria's civil war is in its eighth year. The carnage has been unspeakable. Hundreds of thousands dead, millions displaced, untold thousands disappeared into prisons. The United States is committed to ensuring a future political settlement in Syria that honors the will of all Syrians, including Sunni Arabs, Kurds, Christians, Turkmen, and other minorities.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. Thank you.
from Washington.